You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a water quality specialist from the DNR talks about the challenges and opportunities for saving unique ecosystems in Mississippi River backwater areas here in Wisconsin. Now, 24 teams from around the country met in Wausau over the weekend for this year's National Curling Club Championships. While this game of strategy, stones, and brooms on a sheet of ice originated in Scotland back in the 1500s or so, curling has been part of central Wisconsin winters for over a century. The love of curling has been passed down for generations in Wausau. Our next guests say that love was on full display at this weekend's championship event. Kim Soussens is the president of the Wausau Curling Club, and Jim Forrest is a member of its board of directors. Kim and Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today. Kim, can you tell us a little bit about the field of competitors this year and how far they
came? Thank you for having us.
You bet.
I think we got a little delay there. Kim, can you tell us a little bit about the field of competitors this year? I think, we'll bring this down for a second, see if we can connect in another way with our guests. Sounds like a pretty big delay. Hey, if you're a fan of curling yourself, we'd love to hear from you. Shoot us a note. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or call. Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll try to sweep up this connection here a little bit and get that delay out of there. Love to hear from the curling fans out there. I know a lot of central Wisconsinites are curlers themselves. Well, let's take a moment and check out our Wisconsin life this week, shall we? And then we'll see if we can get this cleared up. St. Patrick's Day was last Friday. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about Irish culture.
Irish dance has been booming for quite some time in Milwaukee, where there are multiple dance schools. If you're not familiar with this art form, Irish dancers typically keep their arms straight at their sides while their legs quickly leap, kick, and shuffle across the floor. Usually, St. Patrick's Day is a huge day for dancers as they travel across the area performing for people. While the pandemic has impacted their events this year, dancers and instructors have found a way to keep hopping and stepping in a safe way. So, to celebrate that dedication to the Irish culture, we're revisiting this story from 2014. Back then, my sister and I attended an Irish dance competition, known as a fesh, in Oconomowoc. We were Irish dancers when we were much younger, so it was super fun to watch the talented dancers, see how the reels and jigs have evolved, and to hear the live music. Take a listen.
A fesh? No one knows what a fesh is. A fesh is an Irish dance competition. It is craziness, but it's a competition where kids get to come and dance. We have 930 competitors. They come, they do two steps of a dance on stage. We have reels, we have jigs, we have slip jigs, hornpipes, treble jigs, sets. I am Maura Kathleen Heck, and I'm an Irish dance teacher and owner of Cashel Dunhe School of Irish Dance in Milwaukee.
It's just really fun. You get to fly, which is awesome. And I don't know, it just takes everything else that you're stressed about away, and you just get to focus on dance. My name's Siobhan McPhail. I'm 14. I dance with Kinsella Academy of Irish Dance, and I live in Milwaukee. I think it's definitely a sport because you need to have stamina and strength and flexibility and anything that any other athlete needs.
I'm Mariana Papa George. I'm 13 years old, and I dance for the Trinity Academy, Mequon, Wisconsin, or Milwaukee. I competed in the under 14 Open Championship category, and I just finished my treble jig. This dress, it's baby blue. It's a lot of white. It has a lot of accents on it that's like a Celtic design, and it's kind of like a tennis skirt style. And then my mom added some blue crystals along the sketching of the skirt and then to the bodice.
The dresses many years ago used to be more authentic, and they would actually had Irish designs on them from this book called The Book of Kells. They've evolved into more geometric shapes and bling, as everyone calls it. And the hair, I can't. There's folklore about, you know, oh, back in the days of ancient Ireland, like they all curled their hair and it, so it bounced nicely as they, you know, were dancing down the aisles and dancing at the crossroads. When I was younger, we actually had to put the little pink curlers in our hair and sleep on them overnight, and your head against a window if you're driving to a fesh in Ohio. oh, it was so painful. And then it took, you know, an hour to uncurl them in the morning. Now they're wigs and they take 5 minutes.
I like to put the wig on the Americans. My name is Sean Beglin, and I am the owner and director of Beglin Academy of Irish Dance. Before I finished high school, I was with Riverdance part-time, which still is a big Irish dance show. I left high school and got a call 2 days later that Riverdance wanted me full-time, and my first city was Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at the Riverside Theatre. We're very lucky to be in Wisconsin. What is great about this city is that in Milwaukee we have Irish dance, plus Irish music, plus Irish singing, plus Irish language. We have Celtic studies. There is such a bloodline of Irish running through this area of America that you can't get away from it.
Those were the voices of Irish dancers at a FESH in Oconomowoc back in 2014 in honor of St. Patrick's Day. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It's Central Time. In just a few minutes, we'll look at another Wisconsin tradition, curling. First, it's the first day of spring, which means we've made it through another Wisconsin winter. We humans aren't the only species who need the right habitat during the winter months. Take bass and bluegill, for example, who like to winter in Mississippi River backwaters. They need the water to be around a certain temperature for a cozy winter season. Our next guest has been tracking these conditions and finding that climate change and other human influences on the river have created challenges for this specific ecosystem. Sean Giblin is a water quality specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources based in La Crosse. Sean, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Paint us a picture of this unique Mississippi River backwater ecosystem you're studying around, I think, Alma it is.
Yeah, so, you know, what we've been seeing lately, too, and, you know, and just sort of the basic biology of, you know, some of these backwater fishes on the Mississippi River, too, you know, they need water that's warm enough, especially the backwater fishes, but with adequate oxygen, too. So it's, you know, there's a very narrow band of conditions that they can tolerate, you know, kind of what we call sort of the Goldilocks zone, where we have, you know, water that's warm enough, but still with adequate oxygen. You know, it's really over the last couple of decades, too, you know, just the increasing discharge we're seeing on the Mississippi River, is making this habitat type increasingly scarce.
When I think of climate change and it's affecting the animal population, I think, oh, well, that means the water's warming up and that's bad for them for some reason. It's actually a little more complicated than that. Can you connect the dots between the impacts of climate change and what's happening, as you mentioned, that water flow through and how it's affecting the habitat?
Yeah. So, you know, in this case, you know, it's a little paradoxical, too, where it's, you know, really it's the volume of water that we're having trouble with, too. You know, if you look at the Winona gauge just north of La Crosse, I think from 1929 to 1980, you know, we never exceeded a mean annual discharge of 45,000 CFS, 1929 to 1980. You know, really since 1980, you know, we've exceeded that threshold 12 times, and seven of those have been since 2010. You know, and really that's a problem, too, because, you know, a lot of these backwaters are connected to channel habitat. You know, in that channel habitat, you know, the water is quite cold in January. So, yeah, typical January water temperature at a channel is, you know, very close to 0 degrees Celsius, too. So, you know, with these backwater fishes needing slightly warmer water, you know, 1 degree Celsius or higher, you know, we're just pumping too much of that cold channel water into these backwaters, you know, making the habitat unsuitable.
Now, in your study, I read that, you know, in normal natural circumstances, there might be ways that a habitat like this could recover itself. But the Mississippi River is not exactly a natural environment when it comes to water flow. We do a lot of management. Is that making it harder for this ecosystem, this backwater ecosystem, to recover?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, sort of a feature of, you know, kind of what we've done to the river, you know, the locks and dams, the navigation channel. You know, it's, you know, the river really, you know, doesn't have the capacity that it once had to, you know, to really rebuild these habitats. So, you know, really it's up to us to sort of assist kind of in building these habitats for fish and wildlife on the Mississippi River.
What would that look like?
You know, many times, you know, it's fairly simple, you know, in these type of scenarios. So for instance, one of these backwaters where we might have too much cold water, you know, moving into this backwater complex, you know, it would be as simple as sort of, you know, shunting some of that flow, you know, into that backwater, you know, to get that right mix of, you know, we're metering in enough of that colder, high oxygen water, but not too much. So, you know, and, you know, in other cases, it could be things like, you know, enhancing the water depth too, but, you know, sometimes it's quite simple. It's just a matter of, you know, changing the level of connection between channels and backwater habitats.
What kind of species are we particularly worried about here?
You know, what we're talking about in this report, you know, is mostly the backwater fish. So these are a lot of the fish that people like to catch, you know, the bass, bluegill, you know, northern pike, yellow perch, crappie, you know, a lot of the sort of high value game fish, you know, which is, you know, people, you know, really like to go out to fish for those species in the wintertime.
Are we starting to see more difficult fishing already, or is this something you're worried about down the road?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's starting to, you know, our fisheries folks are sort of looking at some of these trends too, but, you know, it's like you look at, you know, in general, sort of like, you know, in a number of these backwater complexes that we looked at, you know, in this recent report too, they've, you know, really been unsuitable, you know, particularly during, you know, that decade of 2010 to 2020, where it was just, you know, incredibly, you know, almost 90th percentile flows for that entire decade too. You know, you just look at those habitats that are unsuitable too. So, you know, we are starting to kind of look at sort of the long-term effects of this in terms of overall kind of biodiversity and, you know, these game fish populations on the Mississippi.
Talking to Sean Giblin from the Wisconsin DNR, looking at Mississippi River backwaters here in Wisconsin, important habitats, as you just heard, for some very popular fish here in the state. Threatened in part because of the indirect effects of climate change. Sean, when you're talking about higher levels of flow, is this, you know, a lot more rain, a lot more precipitation, or is it also what we're doing with development in the overall watershed?
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit of both, but, you know, I think the predominant driver is just more precipitation. You know, if we look at that 2010 to 2020 period, you know, a typical, you know, annual rainfall here in La Crosse, you know, slightly over 30 inches, you know, that decade, you know, the average was, you know, 40 inches plus, you know, so, you know, the big driver is just more precipitation throughout the year.
Is this something that, you know, I mean, I've spent time on backwaters in your neck of the woods. Can we see the difference from decade to decade?
In terms of,
like, just
trends?
Visually, would it look different to me if I visited 10 years ago versus now?
Yeah, you know, I think you'd be able to see, you know, just sort of visible velocity moving through these systems too. So it's, you know, we measure something called water residence time, which is the time in days that it takes to flush completely new water into it. So, I mean, in some ways you can see it visually, but in some ways you sort of have to, you know, kind of use, you know, the scientific techniques that we use to observe it.
On a practical level, if we want to do some of the remediation techniques you were talking about earlier, who does that? Who would be in charge of actually implementing things and paying for it?
Yeah, so, you know, we have a couple of restoration programs on the river. You know, there's the Upper Mississippi River Restoration Program, you know, that does projects like this too. You know, there's a number of, you know, complexes, you know, that are actually featured in the report we just released. You know, they're in the queue for restoration efforts too, but, you know, and what we're seeing is, you know, is just the sheer magnitude of these areas that are under stress. You know, it's, you know, we certainly need, you know, more resources than we are to, you know, to really keep pace with the degradation we're seeing too. So, you know, it's a matter of sort of there are programs in place, but, you know, it's just the funding levels that, you know, need to keep pace with the stressors, frankly.
Now, as I mentioned, it's the first day of spring. What are you watching for this time of year to see how these different fish species made it through the winter?
Yeah, so, you know, this is about the time of year too where you'll start to get some of these fish kill reports. You know, the ice comes off too, and to basically look at, you know, kind of, you know, the reports of, you know, various areas where the fish didn't make it through the winter will start to come in too. And, you know, what we did earlier this winter, you know, was sort of look at a number of these backwaters kind of early in the winter and then late in the winter, you know, to look at things like dissolved oxygen and, you know, and how conditions held up too. But, you know, this is typically, you know, the time of year, we'll start to get reports of fish kills, you know, in areas that, you know, the fish succumb to those stressful conditions.
Is this something where you're looking for some citizen science? If people are out there fishing, if they see something, say something to you?
Yeah, you know, we always like to get reports in terms of what's going on too. You know, one thing about the, you know, the river rats on the Mississippi, you know, they tend to be a really observant crowd too. So, you all get a lot of sort of observations throughout the year. You know, they're really, you know, quite helpful in terms of, you know, just, you know, general sort of people you know, seeing, you know, this changing, that changing, you know, it's quite helpful. You know, a lot of people over here, you know, the rivers, you know, it's a big part of their life too. So it's, you know, they're quite invested in it, you know, really aren't afraid to tell us about what they're seeing out there.
What's the next step for your research, Sean?
Yeah, I think it's sort of these applied areas too. You know, we've kind of spent, you know, the last several years kind of, you know, kind of looking at some of these areas, you know, where we know we can apply the science to improve conditions. So, you know, really the next steps are, you know, are really just kind of moving, you know, that science, you know, into action, you know, through these restoration projects. You know, there's sort of a number of them that we looked at, you know, pretty early in this process that are, you know, now in the queue for projects too, which is, you know, encouraging. But, you know, at the same time, you know, where there's any number that are sort of declining as we speak too. So it's, you know, it's going to take a lot of effort to improve conditions.
And just briefly, are you hearing similar stories from colleagues in watersheds in other states in the upper Mississippi?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, this is something we talk about, you know, at sort of, you know, regional conferences on the river too. You know, it's definitely a trend we're seeing up and down the river too. You know, this increasing, you know, volume of water we're seeing is, you know, causing a whole array of stressors on the river too. So it's, yeah, I mean, it's generally sort of, you know, kind of five states sort of speaking in unison in terms of what we're seeing.
Sean, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
That's Sean Giblin, water quality specialist with the Wisconsin DNR. We talked to him today about research he's worked on looking at the effect of climate change on unique Mississippi River backwaters ecosystems near La Crosse. Coming up, a look at a big curling championship here in Wisconsin. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. As I mentioned earlier, there was a big curling championship, the National Curling Club Championship, over the weekend in Wausau. With us, we have Akim Susans, president of the Wausau Curling Club, and Jim Forrest, member of its board of directors. Let's dive in. Kim, can you tell us about the field of competitors and from how far they came to compete?
Absolutely. We had competitors from as far away as Alaska and Los Angeles, all the way over to Massachusetts. It was a great field of competitors and exciting curling.
And Jim, I understand Wisconsin teams didn't come out on top. How far did our local teams come in the competition?
Well, they were very competitive, and I know we saw emails from them this morning. They were really proud to represent the host club. They didn't do that well. They took some of the teams into extra ends, which is like extra innings in baseball. And the women's team actually beat one of the top teams. But the winners came from Colorado and New York State.
And Kim, can you talk about why curling has such a strong connection with Central Wisconsin?
There's a long history of curling. We've been curling. We started on the Wisconsin River in 1922, I think, moved to a curling facility in Marathon Park. And 10 years ago, we opened a fabulous 8-sheet building right in downtown Wausau.
And Jim, can you talk about the Wisconsin curling scene? How active is it? How much goes on through the curling season here in the state?
Well, I think you could safely say that Wisconsin, the Minnesotans might disagree a little bit, but really Wisconsin is the center of curling in the United States. I think we have more curling clubs in Wisconsin than some of the other total regions around the country. And Wausau is right in the center of the state, so we're perfectly located to host an event like this. Curling goes back a long way. As Kim said, our club goes back to the early 1900s when folks were throwing rocks out on the river. I know the Milwaukee Club goes back into the late 1800s, and some of the other clubs around the state are as old as that as well. One of the fascinating things to me as an import from Michigan is that you'll find curling clubs in some of the smallest communities in the state of Wisconsin. I was in one in Arlington a couple of years ago, and I think they have two or maybe three sheets. And it's just a very, very small club, but they're active. They have a strong membership, as we do here. We have a membership of over 400 people. And as Kim mentioned, we have curling families that go back generations. Their grandfathers and great-grandfathers, perhaps, were involved in curling, and some of those family members are still active today.
And Kim, with that in mind, what was the turnout like at this weekend's championships?
We were not sure what to expect. We had great publicity, and a lot of local people came out. There were a lot of families that came to visit their children who were curlers, and it was a very great turnout. We were very, very, very pleased with the people that turned out to watch curling. We had a lot of folks that walked in and said they had never seen a curling match, and this curling was extremely high level and very exciting to watch.
And Jim, just in our last few moments, if someone listening wants to get into the sport, doesn't know how, what would be a good starting point?
Well, our season is wrapping up, but if anyone is interested, they can go to our website, wasacurling.org, and they can click on Learn to Curl, and they can see how the curling game is played and see how they might position themselves as being someone interested in coming out next fall. We'll begin in October, and we'll have Learn to Curl sessions here at the Wausau Club several times. Those are easy to come to. You just need to wear a pair of clean rubber-soled shoes. We'll supply the equipment. We'll supply the instruction. And we like to say in a couple of hours you can learn how to curl.
Well, thanks to both our guests, Kim Soussens, president of the Wausau Curling Club, and Jim Force, member of its board of directors. They joined us with a recap of the National Curling Club Championships held over the weekend in Wausau. Coming up Monday here on Central, or tomorrow, excuse me, here on Central Time. It is Monday. A new book traces the rise of free market anti-government thinking in the U.S. and the big businesses that promoted it. Meet the author of the book, The Big Myth. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then an author shares stories of people dealing with the diagnosis of mental illness and how they shape their identities in moments of crisis in the new book, Strangers to Ourselves. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new bill in the state legislature would update the state's farmland preservation program. We'll talk to one of the bill's co-authors about how it works and what it would mean for farmers and non-farmers alike. First, we often talk in the media and here on this show about big issues related to mental health, access to treatment, peer support, and destigmatizing mental illness, for example. And the world of mental health care relies on individual case studies, clinical descriptions of patients, and their symptoms and treatment. But in a new book, our next guest does something different. She shares profiles of people who are dealing with a diagnosis of mental illness, who talk about their lives and the ways they understand that diagnosis. And she looks into wider connections between people and the societies they live in. In their stories and in her own story, she finds that simple categories don't always match up with complicated real-life experiences. She writes, quote, "They have come up against the limits of psychiatric ways of understanding themselves and are searching for the right scale of explanation." You can let us know what you think by emailing ideas@wpr.org. Have you or a loved one experienced mental illness? How did that affect how you think about yourself, your own identity? Did the medical explanations for your illness make sense to you, or were they difficult to process? You could email ideas@wpr.org. Rachel Aviv is a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of the book Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds and the Stories That Make Us. I talked with her last month. You've been writing about mental health for years now, and you start the book with the story of your own experience at an early age, age six, diagnosed with an eating disorder and hospitalized for it. Can you talk a little bit about your story and how it led you to this book?
It was always something that I didn't know how to make sense of. When I was six, I stopped eating for a few days. I didn't really know why. I just was sort of refusing to do what the adults told me to do. And then my mom took me to a pediatrician, and it was the late 80s at that time. And anorexia was sort of a prevalent fear. And the pediatrician thought I had anorexia and told my mom to take me to the hospital. And then at the hospital, I was diagnosed with anorexia. And I was put on this unit of girls much older than me, who had also been diagnosed. But you know, because I was 6 years old, I never heard that word. I had no idea sort of what made people lose weight or not. Like, it was all very obscure to me. And one of the things I'd always wondered was how much it felt almost like I learned to be anorexic because these older girls were offering themselves as mentors to me in a way. And I really looked up to them and admired them. And it was always something, you know, I kind of was able to recover and I started eating again and I moved on with my life. But I had always had this question of like, what happened to me in that hospital? I was there for 6 weeks. And it was hard to know what came first, whether like sort of being given the diagnosis of anorexia in a way reinforced or sort of encouraged certain behaviors because I had like a new identity among these girls for that period of time.
You have a reading for us. Looking at that experience, that of an older girl that you were there in the hospital with for anorexia and what led you on different paths. Can you share that with us?
Yeah. And just for a little context, mm-hmm. you know, when I was writing the book, I ended up learning about a woman named Hava who had been in the hospital with me, and I'd seen her as a kind of mentor. And I went back and interviewed her family and read her journals. So I'm sort of reflecting on this here. At 6 years old, it still seemed possible that I could become someone else through sheer will. Had I stayed in the hospital longer or returned to a less welcoming school, I may have followed Hava's path. Labels aren't so bad, she wrote in her journal. They at least give you a title to live up to and an identity. My stepmom, the most practical person in my family, has told me she was once doubtful that I'd make it to adulthood. I do have certain traits that make me susceptible to fasting for no reason, like an amorphous sense that self-restraint is a moral good. But I also wonder if I ever had anorexia in the first place. Maybe my limited exposure to the ideal of thinness prevented me from wanting it badly enough. To use the terms of the historian Joan Jacobs Brumberg, who has written eloquently about the genesis of eating disorders, I was recruited for anorexia, but the illness never became a career. It didn't provide the language with which I came to understand myself.
That's Rachel Aviv reading from her new book, Stranger to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds and the Stories That Make Us. Can you talk about the stories of other people that you share in the book and the amazing access you had either talking to people in person or their writings and their family members? What kind of stories were you seeking out here?
I think I was looking for people who similarly felt like they were moving in and out of different frameworks for trying to understand like this period of intense distress. I think, you know, an example would be in the last chapter, I write about a woman named Laura who had grown up in this wealthy community in Connecticut, and she'd gone to Harvard. And when she was at Harvard, she'd been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And for a period of time, she felt like bipolar disorder was her identity. Like it gave her, it sort of explained everything. Like every time she was sad, every time she had too much energy, it was all sort of channeled through the explanation of bipolar disorder. And over the course of 10 years, she ended up taking 19 different medications. Like every time she would come to the doctor, they would give her something new to try to help her. And at some point she realized that like she actually hadn't gotten better at all, that like none of this like extensive, you know, see this sort of new way of seeing everything that was going wrong in her life, it wasn't actually making her better. So she started thinking about like who she was before all of this happened and like whether there had been, you know, problems in her relationship with her family or her relationship with her culture or her environment that was causing distress that like none of these medications could really touch, because like her illness was being treated purely as like a chemical problem.
I want to go into another story that you share of Ray, a man who is at the center of actually a lawsuit involving the question of what's the right way to deal with mental illness, psychoanalysis mm-hmm. at that point versus a biomedical model. Can you tell us a little bit about Ray's story, first of all?
Yeah, Ray it was this really canonical case because in the late 70s, before antidepressants were widely used. Ray was admitted to this hospital called Chestnut Lodge in Maryland, and it was known as sort of the most elite place for psychoanalysis. And the entire hospital was devoted to psychoanalysis. And so he went there, and the doctors didn't use medications. And for 8 months, they tried to, you know, like figure out his relationship with his mother and sort of why that led to the problems in his life. He had been a very successful doctor. And after 7 months, his mother visited him at Chestnut Lodge and saw that he'd lost 40 pounds and that he'd sort of completely lost his identity. And she demanded medications, and Chestnut Lodge said no, that like they didn't think that was the problem. So Ray transferred to a different hospital where he was treated with antidepressants. And it was this sort of miraculous like coming to life. Like in the course of 2 weeks, he kind of regained his sense of humor. He regained his love of reading. He kind of came back to himself. And so then he sued Chestnut Lodge for denying him medicine that he said, you know, he in the 7 months that he was denied medicine, he said that he kind of lost like the pieces of his life. His wife divorced him. He lost custody of his children. He lost his position at his job. And the case became this collision between two ways of understanding the mind, like the biological approach versus the psychoanalytic approach. And Ray ultimately sort of devoted his life to kind of getting revenge on this hospital. He felt like the hospital had taken away his life. And so in the book, I draw from his medical records, but also from this unpublished memoir that he essentially wrote for his entire life, because he felt like if he could finally tell his story, he would get some sort of vindication.
And this seems to be a theme in your book and in a lot of talk, I think, about mental health care lately, is that, you know, sometimes we have the one perfect solution. It's psychoanalysis or it's medication or what have you. And for one person, sure, maybe. And for another person, it might be the opposite. That what I really take away from your stories is it's more than either of those, and it's more than both of those. What are you hoping people take away to add and understand how much more complicated it is?
Yeah, I think there is, you know, psychiatry is often seen as this binary. Like it's either, you know, medical and you use medicine, or it's psychological and you kind of talk it out and you need to figure out your family dynamics. And I think those are two frameworks, and both can be true at the same time. But there are also other frameworks, like you know, the way that discrimination affects a person's mind, or the way that sort of religious crises can like put you into a state of illness, or help you out of a state of illness. So I think that like there's this idea that you need to find one framework to explain what's wrong. And I wanted to show that like these frameworks are not mutually exclusive, and often it requires many at the same time to sort of help a person like refine their sense of meaning.
We're talking to Rachel Aviv about her new book. It's called Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds and the Stories That Make Us. If you are willing to share an experience that this book, this conversation may be ringing a bell about for you or your own family, please do call in. If not, I totally understand. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Rachel Aviv about her new book, Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds, and the Stories That Make Us. Rachel, you foreshadowed another one of the people in your book. I wanted to ask you about a woman from the Twin Cities, just across the border from here in Wisconsin, named Naomi, a tragic story. And you had mentioned looking at the impact of social inequality, of discrimination, as we talk about mental illness. Can you share a little of Naomi's story?
Yeah, Naomi was a young mother with four kids. When she was 21, she basically became convinced that government agents were kind of trying to attack her and her children. And she jumped off a bridge with her two twin sons, who are 14 months old. And she was arrested and put in prison. And the chapter is a lot about you know, the kind of this dynamic of like she had been asking for help leading up to this episode, and she had often been dismissed. Like her, you know, the doctors would look at her and say, well, your life is extremely stressful. So, you know, they wouldn't see her as actually having a mental illness because they thought there were like reasons in her life that she was so stressed out. And then after she was arrested, there was this dynamic of her trying to explain why she had reached this state of crisis. And one of the things going on was that like in her psychosis, she felt like she was waking up to the racism in America and to the experience of being a Black mother in America raising children. And she kind of couldn't see between, you know, like on the one hand, she was having these real insights about the way things work. And on the other hand, it was sort of psychotic in the sense that she lost track with reality. And, you know, once she was arrested, she wanted to plead guilty and say that she was insane, plead guilty by reason of insanity. But she wasn't allowed to because the doctor said, like, well, actually, the insights you have about the nature of society are true. So therefore, this person's not insane. And so she ended up in prison for many years. And the conversations I had with her were about kind of grappling with this confusing dynamic of like, some of the things that were causing her distress were real. And you had like teasing apart what was an illness versus what was distress caused by the way she was raised and the kind of discrimination and trauma she had experienced. And I think that dynamic is really confusing and is one that psychiatrists sort of struggle to weed apart.
Let's bring on a caller now. Sandy is with us in Waukesha. Sandy, hello.
Hello. I wanted to just bring up something that's very relevant about healing. I went to Access Mental Health Outpatient in Waukesha County. All the hospitals in the whole county would not take my insurance, so I would have to travel 35 miles for outpatient. And I've only been in outpatient 3 times, and so it's not like, you know, just the access to care. And people with mental health issues, they do need to tell their story. And that's what outpatient's about. And so I really think more people would get healthier or feel better about themselves if they had better access to care, because it is really a very serious problem.
Sandy, thank you so much for the call. Rachel, 2 things there. First of all, I heard you nodding along to just the difficulties with accessing care. Do you want to touch on that?
Right. I mean, it's like we can have the most amazing ideals of what constitutes good care, but if people can't access it and if our insurance doesn't cover it, then like it sort of doesn't exist. So I think that is, you know, the way that insurance limits care is really profound. And I think a lot of the inability of people to tell their stories and have someone hear their stories has to do with the limits that are placed on like doctors because of the way that the reimbursement scheme is structured.
And Sandy also mentioned the importance of, as you just said, people telling their stories. And that definitely rang with me reading your book. You're telling your own story and you're sharing, as you mentioned, Ray's memoir, Naomi's firsthand accounts, other people's writings over the years. How important is storytelling to helping people find their identity after, for example, a diagnosis of mental illness?
I mean, I'm a writer, so I obviously think like storytelling is extremely important for, you know, our sense of self. But I think that, you know, when you have an illness, it can be a kind of rupture in the story that you have of yourself. And you had certain ideas of who you were and who you were supposed to become. And then a diagnosis like changes those ideas. And I think sometimes that diagnosis can change those ideas in a good way and makes you feel kind of liberated and a sense of relief that like, there's a way of understanding yourself that is generative. But I think other times a diagnosis can feel like someone sort of imposing a story on you from outside, and it doesn't feel right, and it feels limiting, and it feels like you're sort of trapped. So I did think that as people, the people that I wrote about, as they began to recover, it did feel like part of that was like rewriting their story of themselves and feeling comfortable with that and feeling like they owned that.
Sandy, thanks so much for sharing your experience with us. We are talking to Rachel Aviv. Her new book is called Strangers to Ourselves. Let's bring on another caller. Rose is with us in Chippewa Falls. Rose, hi.
Hi. I was just calling because I wanted to mention that I'm bipolar, and I had a psychiatrist from Harvard, and he thought he was special and could treat me, and he just did a horrible job, and I ended up getting another psychiatrist that was a whole lot better than the professional Harvard man. And I just wanted to mention that just because they're professionals doesn't mean that they're always great.
Rose, thanks so much for sharing that. I'm glad you found a better experience, a better treatment, and I appreciate you sharing that. Rachel, the ability to move around and find maybe a different treatment is going to work more for me than maybe somebody else. How important is that to be able to do?
Well, I do think it's interesting that, you know, something that came up in the stories that I wrote were like that we have this idea, you know, that you're alone, you're in a mental health crisis, and you need a psychiatrist to help you. And that may be very true, but sometimes the help that people got wasn't necessarily from an expert. It was like from a friend or from someone who had gone through mental illness themselves. Or, I mean, let me just clarify, like that it wasn't that they, you know, the psychiatrist or the doctor is the only one who can prescribe medicine. But I just noticed that, like, you know, in terms of telling one's story and feeling heard and feeling a sense of like fellowship, I think that that can come from non-expertise, that can come from other people who've had mental illness. Or I think for Naomi, like the woman that was in prison, she developed this incredible relationship with the prison librarian. And through that relationship, she kind of felt less alone and felt like she understood her own experiences better. So I think that's like, it's an unfortunate thing that so often, like, the one person who we feel comfortable telling our stories to is in a position of, you know, maybe not being the right person to like receive it.
Rose, thanks for sharing your story. Rachel, there are a lot of things I think to take away from your book and no simple, easy answers, but it seems like one thing that we keep coming back to is the importance of our social connections as mm-hmm. we deal with a diagnosis of mental illness or concerns about it. In our last minute or so, can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, I think it's isolation and loneliness that is not just, you know, that really exacerbates mental illness in a profound way. And it's the sense of like finding a community or finding someone who doesn't think, you know, like, mental illness can make you feel like you sort of exist outside of the social world. And I noticed that as people recovered, it was because they were sort of being drawn back into the social world through one or another method. And it didn't have to be the same method, but like, it just felt like there was a way in which I think we've all underlooked like how healing a community is.
Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing these stories with us.
Thank you.
That's Rachel Aviv, staff writer for The New Yorker. She talked to us about her new book. It's called Strangers to Ourselves, Unsettled Minds and the Stories That Make Us. Coming up after the news, a co-author of a bill updating Wisconsin's farmland preservation program joins the show to share how it works. And then we'll look at some of the biggest preservation and conservation challenges facing farmers here in the state. If we're talking about you, we'd love to hear from you. If you're a farmer, do you participate in this farmland preservation program or do something else when it comes to sustainable farming? And in your community, are you seeing more farmland get turned into something else other than farming? Love to hear from you. You can email right now at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.